Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Turkey's central bank took steps today to free up cash for banks as the country grapples with a currency crisis. The Turkish lira continued to lose value against the dollar over the weekend after nosediving on Friday. It's down more than 40% against the dollar this year. Now, Friday's drop came after President Trump tweeted that he had authorized the doubling of U.S. tariffs on Turkish steel and aluminum. He said our relations with Turkey are not good at this time. The White House is punishing Turkey for holding a U.S. pastor on espionage and terror-related charges. Joining us now is the BBC's Selin Giret, who is in Istanbul. Selin, first of all, how much of an economic crisis is there at this point in Turkey?
It feels like a full-blown currency crisis, but we cannot yet call it an economic crisis. And if you ask the government is putting on a very brave face at the moment, and they are calling this actually a plot against Turkey, a plot against Turkish economy. And President Recep Tayyip Erdogan today repeated those words, and he said attacks on Turkey's economy were taking place, and he predicted the lira, the Turkish currency, would return to rational levels soon. And he said this is a plot rather than economic fundamentals, and people are spreading false news about Turkish economy, and this was treason, he said. And we have to underline this as well, I believe. The Interior Ministry announced today that an investigation was opened against nearly 350 individuals who posted comments on social media, controversial comments, as they put it, treachery comments, as they put it, which were criticizing the government's take on the economy.
And the U.S. is taking the steps that it is taking, the Trump administration, because this pastor, this American pastor, Andrew Brunson, is being held under house arrest in Turkey. Do you think it's likely that the pastor will be released to relieve some of the pressure on the economy there?
Analysts are saying that that is a step Ankara needs to take in order to ease the tensions with the U.S. However, Ankara is not giving in, and Ankara is pushing to use the detention of the American pastor Andrew Brunson as a bargaining chip to get what it wants from Washington. For instance, the extradition of Fethullah Gulen, the cleric whom Ankara thinks is behind the coup attempt that took place 2 years ago. There are other requests as well, and Ankara wants to use, as I said, Mr. Brunson as a bargaining chip. And Mr. Erdogan has commented on this as well. And he said, we are together in NATO and you stab your strategic partner in the back. Can such a thing be accepted, Erdogan said. And it doesn't look likely that this issue will be solved. But Washington reportedly gave Turkey a notice until Wednesday to solve this issue. Otherwise, further sanctions would follow, they said.
And it would be pretty surprising if Washington decides to extradite Gulen, who's been living in Pennsylvania. That's been an issue for a number of years now. There are questions about whether Turkey, as a result of this tension with Washington, will cozy up more to President Putin and to Russia.
That is a concern for the West, but that is a game Ankara has been playing for some time. It is looking for other partners, other friends, other alliances outside the Western world, NATO. And interestingly enough, on Friday, Mr. Erdogan has held talks with Mr. Putin just after Donald Trump's tweet putting further extra tariffs on Ankara. And Ankara has repeatedly said that it would be looking for other partners, and Russia and China would be the partners that Ankara would be seeking.
Now, when you look at what's happening with the currency in Turkey, if you look at a chart of what's happened over the last year or so, it's been trending down a little bit, and then it just falls off a cliff when President Trump put out that tweet about raising the tariffs on Turkish steel and aluminum. I remember being in Turkey in 2003 when it was something like 1 million Turkish lira to the dollar. They changed the currency. There's a new Turkish lira as of 2005. But is there fear that the inflation is going to be as bad as it was back in the day, that this is going to really make things so much more expensive for Turks?
Turkey's economy had been facing some very challenging issues for a while. There is the inflation, as you have put it. It has reached an annual rate of above 15% this year. There is a huge current account deficit combined with high levels of debt in the private sector and significant foreign funding in the banking system. But the feeling here in Turkey is that this is, at the moment, a currency crisis. And if the government takes the necessary actions, then this could be solved. And that is what the international markets are hoping for. For instance, a promise of interest rate hikes is predominantly what markets and analysts are looking for. But President Erdogan is vehemently against that. He has notoriously called interest rate hikes mother and father of all evil, for instance, repeatedly. And although the central bank has said they would take all necessary measures to ensure financial stability, promising to provide banks with all the liquidity they need, that probably, as of yet, is not enough. They want to see the government putting in more effort, take more actions.
That's the BBC's Selin Garrett speaking with us from Istanbul, Turkey. Selin, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, today we learned that now former FBI agent Peter Strzok was fired on Friday. He helped lead both the Clinton email investigation and the FBI's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Until anti-Trump texts he sent to an FBI lawyer he was having an affair with surfaced. In June, Robert Mueller expelled Strzok from the Russia investigation, and he's been appealing outright dismissal since. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing is here. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Robin.
And we know Strzok's lawyer was making the case, or trying to, that those emails from last year during the campaign in which Lisa Page asked Strzok if Trump might really win and Strzok responded, "We will stop him." Those were his personal views, meaning voters would stop Trump. That if Strzok had really wanted to hurt the Trump campaign, he could have leaked that the campaign was under investigation for possible coordination with the Russians. Of course, he didn't do that. But it sounds like these arguments did not go over with the FBI deputy director who made this decision.
That's right. We understand from Strzok's attorney today that the FBI's Office of Professional Responsibility had recommended a less stringent punishment for Strzok after all this Sturm und Drang about his role in the story. Strzok's attorney said the OPR wanted to give him basically a demotion and some time off without pay, but the deputy director, Mr. Bowdish, decided that instead Strzok would be terminated altogether, which is the news that they've confirmed this morning. This took place on Friday afternoon, so we are just learning about it now, but this has actually been in effect since before the weekend.
Yeah, and we remember when Strzok testified before lawmakers last month, he was skewered by Republicans who just didn't buy it when he said that his personal beliefs never entered into his actual work.
This isn't just me sitting here telling you. You don't have to take my word for it. At every step, at every investigative decision, there are multiple layers of people above me, the assistant director, executive assistant director, deputy director, and director of the FBI, and multiple layers of people below me, section chiefs, supervisors, unit chiefs, case agents, and analysts, all of whom were involved in all of these decisions. They would not tolerate any improper behavior in me any more than I would tolerate it in them. That is who we are as the FBI.
But Phil, this is, as you know, the Washington Post is putting it, a remarkable downfall for a 22-year veteran.
It is, and it is the latest example of an FBI official being eliminated or terminated as part of the outcome or aftermath of these big investigations in 2016, the one into the Russian attack on the election and the one into Hillary Clinton's use of her private email server while she was Secretary of State. The former director, James Comey, was fired by the president. The former deputy director, Andrew McCabe, was fired upon the recommendation of the attorney general. And now this Strzok has been fired as well, as we're learning about. We understand that there was a tweet by the president pointing out that.
Here it is. Let's
Pointing out that fact.
Yeah. Agent Peter Strzok was just fired from the FBI. Finally, the list of bad players in the FBI and DOJ gets longer and longer based on the fact that Strzok was in charge of the witch hunt. Will it be dropped? It is a total hoax. No collusion, no obstruction. I just fight back. How does this color the Russia investigation? Because the president even tweeted over the weekend about Peter Strzok. How does this color it?
That's a great question going forward, because on the one hand, this is excellent ammunition for the president and Republicans who have spent months really sandblasting quite effectively the FBI and the Justice Department. NPR and other news organizations have done polls finding how partisan this appears to Americans now, and that your party identity is likelier than ever to color the way you perceive of these investigations. Republicans more likely to disapprove of it, to view it as a witch hunt in the way the president describes. Democrats taking the opposite view, which is, from the White House perspective, probably a good political outcome here to shade it in that way. But over the long term, now in the president's construction, these bad eggs are getting taken out of the barrel. And so how much more can the president and Republicans charge that the Justice Department and the FBI are these kind of warrens of treachery that they've been describing for so many months? Because Comey's out, McCabe is out, Strzok is now out, and I presume there are no more other stories that are as destructive as these have been for those political purposes. And so we will just have to see how productive those political attacks are going forward.
Phil, we just have a few seconds here. Speaking of which, do we know any more about whether or not and when the president might speak with Robert Mueller and take questions?
We do not. One thing we know is the White House believes there's a ticking clock here, that this can only go until Labor Day, because the White House says Mueller doesn't want to be seen as influencing the midterm elections. And if, in fact, that is the case, we have a calendar of about 3 weeks until Labor Day, and then they expect the special counsel's office to go quiet. We do not know from the special counsel whether he'll actually do that.
NPR's Phil Ewing, National Security Editor. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a trip now into the largest private real estate development in the history of this country. It's in, where else? New York City, on the west side of Manhattan, next to the Hudson River. Its first phase includes six skyscrapers, many of which are currently under construction. They range from 780 to 1,296 feet in height. For comparison, the tip top of the Empire State Building is 1,454 feet off the ground. Construction on five of these six new towers will be finished next year, and only just started 6 years ago.
Well, I think the dream is to create a new urban environment, the likes of which we haven't really seen before. That's responsive to the 21st century, you know, capitalizes on the desire for people to live in cities and sort of raise the bar for what a city can mean for everyone. I mean, we now have over half the world's population living in cities for the first time ever. It's a pretty important shift.
That's Jay Cross, the president of the Hudson Yards project, which is being undertaken by Related Companies, a real estate firm. We met with him on the 24th floor of 10 Hudson Yards, the first skyscraper to be completed. It's already home to Coach, Kate Spade, L'Oreal USA, SAP, and a host of fashion, technology, and media companies. Cross says the urban shift that's happening in America means today's skyscrapers need to be very different than those built nearly a century ago.
That means creating a, we often say, live, work, play environment, but I think more importantly, it's creating a mixed-use environment that's vibrant 24 hours a day, that is diverse in lots of different ways, and has something to offer everybody. So everybody wants to be there for some reason.
When you say mixed use, how much of this is going to be residential? How much of it is going to be commercial or other things?
So it's about 20 million square feet when we're all said and done. And of that, probably 80-plus percent is 50-50 between office and residential. But we don't build it that way. We tend towards office in the beginning, and then we tend towards residential in the back half because we want to create a sense of place quickly. We got to get critical mass and density quickly. And so by building four office towers and a million square feet of retail, you know, we're able to create a destination right off the bat. While we would say retail, residential, and commercial are the three essential components of a mixed-use community, what's really important is that you've got to intensify those uses, and you intensify them with all the little things that you do in between those uses. So the public
like
space.
Like what?
The public space, the gardens, the shed, the vessel, the observation deck, mass transit.
Let's explain a couple of those. The vessel is a giant $200 million sculpture comprised of 154 interconnecting flights of stairs. The shed is a $600 million arts center with an outer shell that can expand and contract. There will also be restaurants, gyms, and a hotel.
All these things create a sense of community that touches every aspect of live, work, and play.
Can you do that right away? I mean, you're saying that you want that to start very quickly, that this feels like there's a sense of place here.
Yeah, we think we're on track to do that. We'll open by next March. So come the spring of 19, the first half will be open. It'll create a destination the likes of which New Yorkers have never seen. And I think part of the issue for us is that until they see it, you can't really imagine it.
How do you make sure that people are actually living in these buildings and that it's not investors, maybe foreign investors, who buy them but then don't live here and then don't help you create that sense of place?
Well, it's very difficult to sort of legislate that you have to live there. I think it depends on the nature of the resident. So if you're a young millennial worker, you're going to be living there because you're going to be paying a lot of your paycheck out in rent. If, on the other hand, you're a retired couple and you're empty nesters and you want to keep the family home in Westchester, or you've got a retirement space in Florida for the winter, you're going to be there a good portion of the time, but you're not going to be there 100% of the time. That's what New York City is. I mean, New York City has a lot of people that live here. Obviously, 8 million people do.
Right.
But there's an awful lot of people that own residence here that have multiple residences in different cities.
I imagine, though, that a lot of New Yorkers, as they watch these beautiful glass towers go up, they wonder, will I ever be able to afford to live in a place like that?
Well, we certainly hope they can. I mean, just behind us here, we have two rental buildings, close to 600 units. And we've opened in the last 2 years and they're 100% leased. And we'll be building affordable accommodation as well at Hudson Yards. And we'll be building condos too. So I think the whole concept is that there's something for everybody. Because of the cost of living in New York City, we're conscious of new segments of the residential market, super small units, the seniors community. We're finding that seniors, for instance, still want to stay in the city because the city allows them to stay vibrant. They like to walk out onto the street and see what's happening. So that perhaps suggests a different model for seniors living in an urban environment.
When I look at this, you know, series of glass tall buildings and you hear about the celebrity chefs that will be locating their restaurants in here, it sounds a little like Las Vegas. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, the buildings are all tall, that's true, but they're not all glass. So we have stone all over the place.
Okay.
And we're very mindful of not trying to create a skyline of all tall glass buildings. But to answer your further question on the restaurants, food and beverage is a huge important element of any urban environment, and it's particularly true in New York, where people dine out a lot. And so having lots of restaurant options, which includes celebrity chefs, but also includes Shake Shack and Sweetgreens, which you passed on the way in here today, and Momofuku. And we've got probably five different coffee shops. I mean, we're trying to be very mindful of what the public want and more or less demand today in terms of a full dining experience. And that dining experience is important because it goes to late at night. Starts early in the morning, it goes to late at night. And that also is an important attribute.
Keep a lot of people.
You
got to
keep
all
a lot of the new worker. So a big part of what we've done today is build what we call the workplace of the future, because we're mindful of the workforce of the future. And that workforce of the future want to do everything in one place. If they can live here, they would. If they can't, they're going to spend as much time here as they can. And that means that their leisure time and their eating time and their dining time. And so we ask all our retailers to stay open till 10 at night, because you want that constant dynamic neighborhood feel.
Jay Cross takes us on a tour of some of the unfinished parts of Hudson Yards. The ground floor of one tower has that new building smell. The marble floors are protected with plywood. There's caution tape blocking the many new and unused escalators, and the ceilings are many stories above us.
So this is just a big racetrack. So there's retail in the middle, and there's retail all around the outside.
This is going to be basically a mall in here.
We don't like to use that word.
Why not?
Because a mall is generally one level. You know, it's a horizontal suburban exercise. We're seven levels. And seven levels in America is very unusual. Seven levels in Asia is not uncommon at all. So,
But this is going to be all retail right here where we're walking.
It's all retail. Everything we're walking through is retail. We're going to come out on the corner of 33rd and 10th, and then we're going to walk along to 30 Hudson Yards, which is all office.
The buildings have been designed to group together various industries. One tower, for example, was built for law firms. Another was made for hedge funds and investment companies.
Here we're down in the hole. We're building our way up. This is the building that BlackRock will occupy. And then 55, you can see ahead of you, the lawyer's building. That building will actually open before the end of this year.
This may sound like any construction site. But remember, we're just blocks from the busiest train station in America. New York City is buzzing all around us. The city has just expanded one of its subway lines to bring people to Hudson Yards with a new station that just opened in 2015 right underneath the site.
This street is 33rd Street. We had to completely rebuild the street on behalf of the city.
Wow.
So it used to go down and then come up. And so we leveled it all off, rebuilt the street, relay the utilities. And then underneath here, we have a tunnel connection that goes from 30 Hudson Yards to 50 Hudson Yards. There'll be another tunnel connection from 50 Hudson Yards under Hudson Boulevard into the number 7 subway. And that's why I was able to make the statement. You'll be able to get on a train in Stamford and come here and never go outside.
This is probably the first time in a long time that 33rd Street has been a dirt road.
Yeah, that's true. But it was once upon a time.
It was.
Once upon a time, this spot was a wasteland compared to much of the rest of Manhattan. I asked Jay Cross if the city's public transit system, even with a new station, will be able to handle all of the people who will live and work in this new development.
I mean, I think it's all a question of scale. So 600,000 people a day go into Penn Station. Mm-hmm. We have 40,000 office workers. Only about 10,000, maybe 15,000 of those office workers come in through Penn Station. So are we really going to move the needle on Penn Station? I don't think so. Is Long Island Railroad and New Jersey Transit going to increase capacity? Absolutely, they have to. That's the goal for the region.
You're also right next to the Hudson River. Have you thought about that in your plans, maybe of you know, in the future, rising waters? Is that making you do anything differently?
Well, we did a few things differently as a result of Sandy. So the rail yards did flood during the Superstorm Sandy. But the rail yards are only 7 feet above sea level. So, yeah, we had certainly plus 7 foot rise. But our ground floor, because we have to build over the trains, is more like 40 feet above sea level. And so that's above the 500-year flood. So the idea that we would ever have water in our ground floors is pretty remote. But we do have elevator pits that go down close to the trains, and we have oil tanks down there. People would say, well, if the, you know, if the elevator pit floods, it'll just knock out the control system. You know, it won't be that bad. I said, that's still unacceptable. I can't have the elevator control system knocked out. So we actually submarined all of the elevator pits so that if the water comes up around the pit, it's not in the pit, and therefore all the control systems are still up and running. And so we made a number of changes like that.
Right now, to get to the top of the tallest new skyscraper on the site, you have to take what's called a hoist. It's a metal cage elevator that brings construction workers up more than 1,000 feet. We donned our hard hats and work boots to take a ride.
We're still going up.
Yeah, this is KKR's top floor, 63. See their views even more significant still.
Tomorrow, we'll continue our tour of Hudson Yards and look at the comparison to other projects of this scale, including one that used to define this city's skyline.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
In some cities, you now need a smartphone to pay for parking on the street. Now, for instance, in many neighborhoods in Miami, the local parking authority has removed 99% of individual parking meters, along with half of its multi-spot machines. The only way to pay often involves a specific app. That can be convenient, but it can leave some people behind. Danny Rivero from member station WLRN reports.
4P, press 1. 4Q, press 2. 4R, press 3. 4.
Are you listening to this?
On a recent morning, I noticed Joe and Tien standing on a corner looking up at a street sign in frustration. She was trying to pay for parking.
We can't get in with the app, so I'm attempting to do it over the phone, which is just so much work. It could be easier.
And Tien tried to download the PayByPhone app. She called the number but was confused. She was heading to an event and was already late, and now she's dealing with this.
There's some areas when you come downtown that they have the machines, which is easier, like if you go by the courthouse, for example.
And Etienne is not alone in her frustration. In 2008, Miami became the first major U.S. city to introduce pay-by-phone technology. The company says 9 out of 10 parking spaces in Miami are paid for through pay-by-phone, one of the highest usage rates in the world. On the one hand, using pay-by-phone is incredibly convenient. But it also requires users have a smartphone with updated operating systems. and some report having trouble opening the app when needed. Still, Art Noriega, the CEO of the Miami Parking Authority, says that technology is moving in this direction.
There's so many other cities around the country that look to us in terms of this program, how we set it up, how we marketed it.
Noriega says it only makes sense to move people onto the app because that's where the customer is.
So it really depends on the neighborhood and where we think the utilization is high, where we can start to eliminate the equipment.
But getting rid of parking meters is a big deal. PayByPhone is owned by Volkswagen, the largest car company in the world. And in its terms of service, PayByPhone says that it shares data with police and other government agencies, as well as other unnamed third parties. According to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a digital policy watchdog group, this raises red flags.
They're collecting the license plate, the location, and your name with a credit card.
Rebecca Jeske is an analyst with the group.
So if you are contributing information that goes into a database for whatever reason, then that database becomes available to many other people, whether it's someone breaking into the database or the person who administrates it deciding to share it.
I asked Noriega of the Miami Parking Authority about the wisdom of pushing drivers exclusively onto a private app to legally park in many parts of the city.
Well, I don't know we're forcing anybody to do anything. First of all, to get into the app and use it, you have to agree to the terms of service.
Neither PayByPhone nor Volkswagen responded to requests for comment on this story. Back on the street corner, after 20 minutes, Jo Entien decided to give up on calling PayByPhone since she couldn't get on the app.
I'm just gonna go, because even on the phone is a hassle.
And on this day, she was lucky. When she returned to her car, she didn't have a parking ticket. For Here and Now, I'm Danny Rivero in Miami.
So how did he do it? How did 29-year-old Horizon Air employee Richard Russell, who normally handled baggage and towed planes, how did he steal one, a turboprop, from Seattle-Tacoma International Airport Friday night? And why did he do this? Someone who sounded in his conversations with ground control so poignantly nice. His family and friends called him Bebo. One spoke over the weekend.
We are stunned and heartbroken. May seem difficult for those watching at home to believe, but Bebo was a warm, compassionate man. It is impossible to encompass who he was in a press release. He was a faithful husband, a loving son, and a good friend.
We may never know the why he stole and crashed a plane, but we can answer some of the how questions with aviation expert and former inspector general for the Department of Transportation, Mary Schiavo. And Mary, we're getting two messages here. The transportation security expert Errol Southers said on CBS that this is the greatest threat in aviation, someone working inside. This is a huge deal. But then we have Patrick Smith, who writes the Ask the Pilot blog, saying the average person, if put in a cockpit of such a plane, couldn't get a propeller turning if his or her life depended on it, let alone take to the air. He says this is really an outlier. Where do you fall?
Well, probably between the two, and I suppose that's a good lawyerly response. The answer is it depends. You know, actually, aviation, modern aviation, isn't at all like it was when I learned to fly. I learned to fly back in the late 70s, and you had to go out to the airfield and literally punch holes in the sky to get the feel of your plane. Now, all planes, including this Q400, are completely computerized. This aircraft is literally managed and started by the FADEC system, the Full Authority Digital Engine Control System. So if he did any study, and he said in the recordings with the air traffic controller, if you did any study on a computer on a laptop, you can learn the computers in the plane. In fact, nowadays, a good portion of your training, and it's approved by the FAA, is in a simulator sitting in an office, in a lab, in a classroom, on a computer.
Well, in fact, we just did a brief Google search on YouTube, and you can get a million how to fly a plane tutorials. Here's just a little bit of one.
All right, we'll do our before takeoff checklist, and we'll make sure that our wing flaps are up. And once we get on the runway, we're going to go throttle full open, so full throttle.
Okay, now what you're seeing there is you're seeing the dash of this plane, and you're seeing everything that he's doing. This is a very different plane. This is more like what you were talking about, you know,
yes. That
you had. It was more by feel than by computer.
Right.
But you can get these lessons.
That's right. And in fact, there's one out there that actually has a picture of this plane on the cover of the software. It actually says Alaska Airlines. It's $49. Now, you put that realization in today's modern aviation, meaning that if you're going to flight school, you have a background check. You have to tell the FAA if you've taken any medications, including anything for depression or psychological drugs. But if you're working on the airfield and you're one of the 900,000 U.S. Airport employees in this country, all you have is a criminal background check. You have to prove your identity, meaning fingerprints have to match, your driver's license have to match. Yeah, have to be who you say you are. That's your background check. Mm. So you have people that can learn to fly. And the only exception would be, and he didn't need this, landing. I still think landing takes some skill and finesse. The moment he took off, he couldn't have known how to land it.
Well, and he said many times during the tape, I don't think I plan on landing it. In other words, right. People are seeing this, it's speculation, as a something of a suicide mission. But you talk about how airport workers don't have the screening. It no. doesn't sound as if with this young man, and again, we're speculating here, but it doesn't sound as if they would have found anything anyway. He even says, I have a screw loose, and I don't think I knew that till now. So let's go back to stealing a plane out of a hangar. How do you do that? We know he had access to the tow device. That was part of his job. So he could tow this plane and turn it around. We also know that as part of his job, he could sit in the pilot's seat as it was towed. But how do you then get on a runway and take off without people blocking you?
Well, and that's where it comes back to the airline security program. Each airline has their own security program. And one of the elements that must be in that security program is to prevent unauthorized access to aircraft. Now, there are a lot of ways to do it. In the olden days, you locked them up. But in today's modern environment, you can have access to the aircraft through the computers for towing purposes. But for full authority to actually turn on and operate the airline and to put it into certain modes, what you would have to do in this modern day and age is have a computer lockout. In other words, it would take a pilot's code into the flight computer to allow the plane to be put in any kind of a operational mode other than for towing. So I think airlines will have to look at that, because Congress will probably rev up last year's bill. Remember, the House passed a bill last year as part of the Homeland Security Committee to look at the security or lack of security and the access of 900,000 airport employees. Mm-hmm. By the way, in that report, they found 73 employees at airports in the United States had connections to terror groups. This fellow obviously didn't, but this will open the speculation to saying, well, what if it wasn't this fellow?
Well, as Pearl Jam is playing at the Safeco stadium just a few miles away, he could have crashed the plane there, and he was so sensitive to not even wanting to land it on a strip that the controllers were trying to get him to land it at, because he was afraid he wouldn't be able to do it and he'd hurt someone. Let's listen to just a little bit more of him speaking with those controllers.
So I know you're getting a good view there, but if you go too much further in that direction, I won't be able to hear you anymore.
All right. Hey, pilot guy, can this thing do a backflip, you think?
Pilot guy. At another point, he applauds their professionalism. Mm-hmm. It just is heartbreaking.
It is.
But again, to the question, how did he get down the runway? I've been in a control tower. They've got those little tiles that they move around. They see everything on the runway. How did a truck not block him when he was getting out?
Well, because of the layout of SeaTac and where Alaska Airlines cargo hangar is, it's a very short, straight shot. And the tower there, I mean, it's a new one, but it does have blocked areas on the airport where you can't see everything moving. And what we don't know yet, and this will be on the flight data recorder, is whether he turned on the taxi lights, whether he turned on the lights on the plane. We don't know if he did that. If he didn't turn on any lights, they might not have been able to see it when it first started moving. And if a guy's with the tug is moving a plane around, the assumption is that it's okay. You're just tugging the plane around. Mm. And so between that point and when he actually got in and turned it on, to get onto the runway is a very straight shot.
By the way, how does he get into the pilot seat? Does he climb over from the tug, as you call it, the tow?
No, he has to disconnect it. He has to move the get the tug out of the way, take the tow bar out of the way, and then literally, you know, open the door and go in. Now,
but how does he get up to the door?
Well, see, this plane isn't high in the air. This isn't like a 777 or a 747 or a 380. Mm. This plane has a door, has stairs in it.
Just briefly, it could have been much worse. It yes. has alerted people in the industry that there is a problem. But for those controllers, that must have just been a horror.
Well, it was a horror. And, you know, one of the good things about the controllers that they did is they got him talking. At one point, he asked the controllers if they could help him get the plane pressurized because he was lightheaded. But if he was not at an altitude over 10,000 feet and well over 10,000 feet, hypoxia doesn't usually set in right at 10,000 feet. For him to be complaining about lightheadedness, to me, was a clue. Maybe he was ill. Maybe he had a problem. That, to me, was a clue. And the air traffic controllers, by keeping him talking, learned a lot, going to help in the investigation tremendously. And, you know, by being kind and having a gentle touch with him, you know, perhaps they helped avoid disaster.
Mary Schiavo, thank you so much.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Mary is the former Inspector General for the Department of Transportation. So, did you watch? It was terrifying, sickening for his loved ones. Until it ended so badly, maybe a little thrilling.
Shares in the German multinational company Bayer dropped more than 10% today, the first day of trading after a jury ordered Monsanto, which was recently acquired by Bayer, to pay $289 million in damages to a man who has terminal cancer. The plaintiff was frequently exposed to Monsanto's weed killer Roundup while he worked as a groundskeeper. Monsanto is appealing the ruling. We're joined now by NPR's Dan Charles, who wrote a book about Monsanto and other things, Lords of the Harvest, Biotech, Big Money, and the Future of Food. Dan, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
And first, just tell us about this case against Monsanto.
So the case was brought by a man who worked as a groundskeeper at a school in California. He worked with, you know, Roundup. There were leaks sometimes. He got doused with the chemical from time to time, or at least on a couple of occasions. He was worried about it, and then he got cancer. And then some groups that have been longtime opponents of Monsanto and critics of their products, they sort of came in and, you know, paid for and organized this lawsuit on his behalf, suing Monsanto.
And the jury found Monsanto liable for the groundskeeper's cancer. But this case does not prove the link between Roundup and cancer. What kind of evidence is there that the chemical in Roundup, which is glyphosate, does cause cancer?
This came up, or really became a hot issue 3 years ago when a group of internationally recognized scientists working under the auspices of the World Health Organization put out a report saying that it is probable that glyphosate, you know, the active ingredient in Roundup, can cause cancer. But this has been really controversial, and a number of other scientific groups, including regulatory agencies that are supposed to actually look at kind of real-world consequences of exposure, they have looked at the same studies and come to the opposite conclusion, saying glyphosate does not cause cancer. And they're looking at studies like, you know, experiments with mice and rats and experiments with cells in a test tube, and also epidemiological studies where you look at people that have been exposed to glyphosate. And the biggest of those studies looked at 50,000 farm workers, and it has not seen any effect of glyphosate exposure on those farm workers. So, you know, I would say the majority of the scientific organizations that have looked at this question have come to the conclusion that glyphosate or Roundup does not cause cancer.
At the same time, there are more than 4,000 pending lawsuits against Monsanto by people who believe they got cancer from exposure to Roundup.
Right. And so here's the thing that I find most interesting about this verdict. Basically, the plaintiffs representing Mr. Johnson they put Monsanto on trial. And it wasn't just a trial about scientific evidence. It was also a trial about the company's behavior. And they got access to years worth of internal Monsanto emails. And they found lots of emails that, you know, seemed to show that the company really was not that interested in pursuing any evidence that their products had caused any harm. And that when there was any evidence that came up, they would sort of counterattack and sometimes organize scientists to publish articles on their behalf. So the plaintiffs argued Monsanto is basically skewing the scientific evidence, and so you can't trust it, mm-hmm. and you can't trust the regulatory bodies. So that's sort of the most significant thing, I think. If a jury basically says, we don't trust, you know, the institutions that were actually supposed to protect us, then, you know, it actually ultimately backfires against the company because their credibility is gone.
Well, it's interesting that this case is being decided right now because just last week, a federal appeals court ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to ban sales of another chemical called chlorpyrifos, which is a widely used agricultural pesticide. Tell us about that case.
So it's a very different case. But it's significant, I think, in the same context of, you know, credibility of the regulators, because so chlorpyrifos is clearly a dangerous chemical if you're exposed to it. It's kind of like nerve gas. It's an insecticide. It's not a herbicide like Roundup. And at the very end of the Obama administration, the Environmental Protection Agency actually ordered this chemical to be taken off the market. And then the Trump administration comes in, Scott Pruitt leads the EPA, and they basically reversed that decision and said, we need to study this some more. And this has also been in the courts. And in this case, an appeals court said, no, Environmental Protection Agency, you have to go back to the thing that you said you were going to do at the end of the Obama administration and take chlorpyrifos off the market. But again, it's a case of sort of disputed scientific evidence and the appearance of basically sort of politics driving these decisions.
That's NPR's Dan Charles. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.